Hello, friends! Welcome to the Love and Intrigue. Oh, God bless America. Love and Intrigue Through the Ages panel. We are the Book Besties. I'm Molly. She's April. We love to call ourselves the Genre Fluid Podcast. We talk about everything from romance to me forcing her to read horror. We just wrapped our 8th season. We will be starting season 9 in September. And April is an Ohio native.
OH!
Ohio! Y'all are gross.
We're aware.
I'm from the New York-Pennsylvania border, so we don't talk like this. Like, we're not this proud about it. We just like our cows. April currently lives in coastal Virginia. I'm from the DMV area. April is a children's librarian who really loves inclusivity and making sure children see windows and mirrors. It is important in this world. She loves to evaluate books as the consumer. That is how she sees it for us. I'm the resident writer. I look at it as how the writer would see it. I will either defend you or bring you down, depending on how your choices are, right? Because sometimes we don't agree with what the author says. As authors, we know that those decisions are hard. Mm-hmm. So that's not happening today, ladies, just so you're aware.
That's not what we're here
bring
for.
It.
Molly loves to argue. I'm from the DMV area. I just said that, didn't I? I'm a writer and a Coast Guard veteran. That's how actually we met.
I was not in the Coast Guard.
So, as you see, so let's talk about our beautiful panelists today. So, I want to welcome you guys. So, we have Darcy Wilds, Anne H. Gabehart.
I'm saying that right.
Gabehart. Sorry. And Diane Freeman. Darcy Wilds is a best-selling, award-winning, genre-jumping author. Most recently of historical mystery. I'm so sorry. She started writing when she was 13 years old and has never stopped. Same boo, same. Since then, she has published over 40 novels across a range of genres from sci-fi to romance, and now is in the mystery genre because, you know, sleep's overrated.
Oh, sleep, what is that?
I don't know.
I mean, that went away when I had a kid.
Sleep, who's she?
Yeah.
She describes her current series as the Useful Woman Mysteries as Bridgerton with Dead Bodies. Her upcoming book, The Heir, is the first of her new Young Queen Victoria mysteries. Darcy lives in Michigan with her husband, Tim, and their son, Alex.
We'll forgive you for Michigan.
Oh, yeah. And I make no apologies for the Tigers.
Anne H. Gabehart has been called a storyteller with 40 published books adults and young adults. The title fits. Anne started down the writing road at the age of 10 when she began scribbling a mystery in a wire-bound notebook. Get it, Anne? With a few zillion words later, she's still trying to come up with stories, but now she clicks them out on a keyboard. Same. Her first published writing were personal experiences, pieces, youth stories, and poems in church periodicals, such as Home Life. Her first novel, a historical romance about the settling of Kentucky, was published by Warner Brooks in 1978. How about that career, lady?
Shows how old I am, doesn't it?
We're not talking age, we're talking years. It's a difference. Since then, that's a word I don't know. Primarily writes novels, except for coming up with almost 2,000, I'm sorry guys, blog posts for her One Writer's Journal online. Anne likes to wrap her stories around Kentucky historical times and settings because it's beautiful. She writes about Shakers and the Outsiders and other titles, explored Appalachian history for stories like The Songs of Southern Sourwood Mountains, I'm sorry, and Mind Family Histories for Angel Sisters, Sense of Lilac, and more. For her new release, The Pursuit of Elena Bradford, Anne stepped back to the 1840s for a historical Kentucky setting of Graham Springs Hotel, where people went to take in the waters for various illnesses and to enjoy the entertainments at what was sometimes called the Saratoga of the West. Anne and her husband of many, many years have 3 children and 9 grandkids. She keeps her keyboard worn out. I'm sure you can't even see the letters by now. Like, you just know where they are, right?
Some of my keyboards did wear out the letters.
Yeah. Kentucky Farm, where her dogs, Frankie and Marley, she makes sure she gets plenty of exercise. I'm sure they do. Diane Freeman is a USA Today bestselling author of Agatha and the Left Award-winning Countess of Harley Mystery. I'm dyslexic, gang. I apologize. She has been a finalist for the Mary Hings Clark Award and the Sue Fetter Historical Mystery Award. After 30 years of corporate accounting, right, babes? She lives her dream of writing full-time. Same.
Good for you.
Same. Born and raised in Michigan, she and her husband split their time between Michigan and Arizona.
What a beautiful. We'll also forgive you.
Yes. So how about some questions, friends, huh? Diving into the past is the reason we all love historical fiction so much. How did you all get into historical fiction? Anybody?
I'm a history nerd.
Yeah.
Flat out. I've always read and loved history. And when I was starting out writing science fiction, I mean, one of the best ways to get ideas to build a world from scratch is to read about the history of our world. Because we have pretty much tried every way of living together under all available circumstances. So if you're going to have to extrapolate out, you need to see where it is. And so I literally stopped writing science fiction because I got tired of saying, well, let's do the Renaissance in space.
Why can't I
just do the Renaissance?
Right. But I'm sorry, I want you to answer as well, but I just want to say what people don't always realize is that sci-fi comes with so much research. So you
did. Oh my God.
People think that because seriously, it's the future, you're inventing it, so it doesn't matter. But if you don't base it in reality, it won't be good sci-fi. I'm a huge sci-fi fan. So. Princess Leia.
Oh, the places we could go with that. Whole nother podcast.
That's a different episode.
Well, I got into historical fiction because many, many years ago when I first wanted to publish a book, I wrote a book that was considered a gothic. And I sent it off to this agent that actually took me on. And she wrote me back and said, it's very good, but gothics are going out of style at this time. Like I said, this was a long time ago. Why don't you try historical? Historical romance is very popular right now. And I said, well, I don't like history. I never liked history in school. I was still very young at the time. And so she said, well, just try it. So I found out that when you are reading history that you want to read instead of what the teacher wanted you to read, it's much more interesting. And I have loved history ever since.
Yeah, similar to that. I probably from the first Jane Austen novel I've ever read. 13 years old, it was a lot more absorbable than the history I was learning in high school.
Yeah.
You know, just much more so. Started going into, after, you know, of course, read the rest of her novels, then tried like Henry James and Edith Wharton, but again, I was 13, so it was not very accessible. And of course, those really weren't historical fiction. They were just written a long time ago.
So it felt it.
Yes, so the librarians, try historical fiction. Let's look at that. And I did, and it never looked back. I just love history.
And there, no matter what historical fiction you're writing, it could be a mystery, it can be deep in horror, all of that, there's a fantasy element to historical fiction. Because you are reinventing a time that none of us will directly experience.
Right. Yep.
Well, you're bringing it all from a contemporary point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you know, the business of the past is a different country.
Yeah.
And Ursula Le Guin, in fact, talked about that when writing about the future. She said, it's impossible to write about the future. You can only write about the now.
Right.
So when we write historical fiction, we are of necessity reimagining the past from our current point of view. People, you know, will go around saying, well, you can't apply today's standards to the past. Yes, you can. Yeah, you can. You can. You're going to. You're doing it right now.
Because you look back and you're like, because if you're not angry about things you've seen in history, you're not paying attention to history, right? And that's kind of why we write historical fiction, because we're going to highlight the things that make us angry. We want to talk about them. We're going to highlight them. Take our podcast friend, Addison Armstrong.
Yeah, we love Addison Armstrong.
Addison writes about women in difficult situations. Like these ladies write about women doing difficult things because times were difficult for women. And that's why we read historical fiction, because we want to see that we're not the only people struggling, right? We're struggling now. They struggled then. It's just different problems. And also, nobody asked. I blame American Girl dolls for my historical fiction. Because I was Molly, and my grandmother was the same age as Molly. So
yeah, but now American Girl dolls have dolls from the 90s, and that's just rude.
That's really gross. That's really gross. Historical fiction is a wonderful genre because we can use it to tap into several other genres, right? That's the whole point of why we're here, mystery, right? We got mystery, suspense, romance. It gets to tell stories through filtered lenses that we probably don't always get to dip your toe in other genres. So can you guys tell the audience your favorite part about adding an extra genre into historical fiction? You all write different variations of it. We have mystery, we have romance, we have love, we have murder. Like, please share, friends.
A long time ago, I took a class called The Mystery Novel as a Social Commentary. Mm-hmm. And I had never really thought about it that way before, but it is very true. If you want to see how a society really works, subject them to a crime.
Right.
And see how they react to that. Also, you get to see not only what crimes were happening at a particular era and time, but what motivated them.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays you probably wouldn't get anybody killing somebody because their father made them marry a man they didn't love. You know, that just doesn't happen.
I've seen a few arranged marriages still.
That is true. But also, who gets out of it? How do the people react? In the era that I write, which is I'm right around 1900, nobody wants to talk to the police. But if you're an aristocrat, you can get away with not talking to the police. They really have, yes, absolutely, and status. Now, the superintendent of police generally was also aristocrat, so they could work it up. If the officer really thought you were guilty or you had something important to contribute, they could then present it to the superintendent, and then the superintendent will come talk. But it's a lot of hoops to jump through. So you had that layer of protection. And it's just, I just feel like it really exposes so much on probably some more things that I'm just not thinking of at the moment.
I can't remember who the author was. It was years ago, but I remember him saying, your book feels boring, put a dead body in the middle of the scene and see what happens.
Because you get a reaction, and you get the reaction of that particular society at that time.
And it's not a mystery book, but my favorite book of all time is To Kill a Mockingbird, which is centered around a community that's dealing with a crime. I mean, we all, if you've read it, we know what happened.
If you made it through middle school, you've read it, right? Or pretended to.
I taught it in high school. I taught it to high schoolers. But it's my favorite book of all time because I think it's a lens. It was written in the 60s about something happening in the 40s. And when I used to teach it to high schoolers, I taught in a predominantly African-American school, and my students were like, this still happens. And it was amazing for them to be interactive with that.
Mirrors.
That is one of the sad things about writing historical fiction, is that problems you're dealing with hundreds of years ago, and they're still around.
Well, of course, I am sort of the odd man out in this panel because I really don't write mysteries. I write Christian inspirational fiction that sometimes have a mystery thread in them.
Mm-hmm.
And this book does have a little more suspense than most of my books do, but most of my books are just historical fiction. And I don't have dead bodies in my books.
But there's a huge market for inspirational fiction.
I'm the man out or the lady out in this particular panel.
You still have an amazing market. You still have an amazing pocket. You still have an amazing readership.
I did.
And that's
why
you've been doing it for so long.
I did. I have written 3 cozy mysteries. They were the Hidden Springs mysteries. They do not have those books here. The books that they have here are all inspirational.
Check your local
historical books. And a few of the books that are here do have a little mystery thread, but the important thread in my book is usually the history, the particular history. this particular history in this one is about the Springs hotels. Yes. And about how people did go to those hotels to find healing.
And
my book, my character Alina, is her family has fallen on hard times, and they may lose their house. She has never met a man she wanted to marry, and so her mother decides she is their solution. She's going to go to Hidden Springs and find a rich man to marry and get them out of their desperate financial situation. But in the process of that, some mysterious things do happen.
Mm-hmm. And I'm building on what both Diane and Anne have said. What's been great for me about delving into, you know, this aspect of the historical genre has been discovering and being able to highlight how much women did do in the Regency, how much power they did have socially, politically, financially. This stuff has been
behind the scenes.
It's not even necessarily behind the scenes. It's been erased.
Yes.
That's history. But women were running businesses at this time.
Yeah.
Women ruled the social scene.
Yes.
Women were founding historical societies. Fun fact, I didn't know this. The word scientist was coined for a woman named Mary Somerville. There's a college named after her at Oxford now. She was predominantly an astronomer, but she was a Renaissance woman. Mm-hmm. She was a mathematician. She was into geology. And they wanted to talk about her, but they could not call her a man of science.
Nope.
So they needed an entire new word. So this was her, and this was that time.
Yeah, I love talking about, with my library kids, I love telling them about how Mae Jemison was also a ballerina and an astronaut, and how there are two women in history that do not get enough recognition. Ada Lovelace, who basically made math.
Yep.
And then Hattie Lamarr is the reason we have Wi-Fi.
Yep.
She is a very beautiful actress, but she's the reason we have Wi-Fi.
Don't forget Grace Hopper.
Yes.
Yep. Nobody believed Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein.
Oh, of course
they
she couldn't do it.
Her husband wrote it. Women are constantly...
She wrote it in one night.
As a challenge, because her husband told her she couldn't. Also, Beth Revis...
She was 16.
Yeah. Beth Revis told us about that, though. Beth Revis also did that.
Yeah.
She was told by a fan that she couldn't do something, and
she's
like...
spite wrote it.
Bet. You three also have a very common theme in your books. Women are clever. Women are independent. And women are strong. Can you tell us your inspiration, why you love to add these little sprinkles into your stories? Because it's not just about the history. You're showing us that women can persevere no matter the time.
Do you want to go, Anne?
Well, I have some books where my lady or my main character is a little bit stronger and more independent than on this one. Actually, she is doing what her family needs her to do. It's 1840, and
you can feel
that
her
can be strong.
But you, when you read your book,
well, just let me answer.
Her strength is there. I promise, her strength is there, Anne. Her strength is there.
So she is doing what she thinks she needs to do. But back in the 1800s, it was a lot different world for all women.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't have a man to take care of them, they really didn't have a lot of options other than marriage or a father or brother to take care of them. And Alina is not sure that she would ever marry at one time. But then, of course, she goes to Graham Springs, and the romance happens, and things do turn out all right, although you're wondering at times. And there is that suspense. But I like making my characters strong and able to rescue themselves and not to necessarily be the damsel in the castle.
Yes.
I wrote a book that one of the books out there is called Along a Storied Trail, and it's set in the Appalachian during the Depression era, and my character is a bookwoman. She takes books up into the hills on a horse. And so she was very strong to be able to do that and take care of her family. So all my characters are strong females, but they do have a lot of family attachments too.
Who doesn't?
I was inspired by the real American heiresses for the last 25 years maybe of the 19th century, these women who their family amassed a fortune, not always through ethical means or ethical business, but they were outsiders. They were not, they would never be able to socialize with Mrs. Astor's upper 400. So they really came up against a wall. And the possible opportunities were, you know, marry beneath you, which they were very well educated and socially polished women, or marry the man your dad brought home from work, that type of a thing. So they took the risk, they took a gamble, and married aristocracy from Europe. And that gave them, that gave their family social cachet, so now they could mingle with the upper crust, and it also gave them a certain power, as Darcy was indicating too. Women ran society in those days, and also they ran the charities that helped society in those times. They generally just didn't work for money, at least women in the class that I write about. But they were, those real women were, they really did these things, and they were an inspiration, because you had to have a lot of courage to leave your family on one continent, go to another continent where this huge dowry that you are buying this title with is going to go to your husband's family. You're never going to see it again. And you don't know how you're going to be treated.
Yeah. Also, you had to ride a boat. Like, that's a long journey.
Yeah, it is.
That's a really long-ass journey, just riding a boat.
Says the person from the Coast Guard.
I'm just saying, it was a long... I never rode a boat from New York City to England. Like, my longest boat ride was, like, Maryland to Maryland, homie.
Even now, it's, like, 8 days.
Yeah.
12 years till the Titanic.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the other thing to remember is we're talking about certain classes of women. Women work.
Yes.
Women have always worked. And, you know, if you were from the middle or the working classes in the, you know, I write around the 1820s. You were working. You were expected to work. You were helping in the family shop. You were perhaps brewing the beer or making the cheese, as well as, you know, doing the counter. You were trimming the dresses. You were, you know, taking in the laundry. You were making shift. You were raising chickens and geese in your backyard for market. Whatever. You were hustling. These women hustled. The problem came in the upper classes, where your gentility literally depended on never touching money.
Yeah.
And yet, even then, these women figured it out. When their husbands and their sons and their brothers failed the family, which happened a lot, because they were always the era I write in was the beginning of modern banking, and there weren't many regulations, and there were a lot of scams.
Yeah.
We can talk about the great stock market scams and crashes that were happening then, kind of like they're happening now. Who needs crypto? we can get into that, but. They had to figure out ways. They would do translation work. They would do fine art. They would do calligraphy. They would become useful women in that they would go around and stay with their friends who would put them up for months at a time, and they would help manage the social calendars, and they would help organize the balls, and they would do the charitable work. In return, they would get use of the carriage. They would get gifts. They would get old dresses. They could maintain their appearances without having to touch the money, which was the factor. So, you know, again, women have always been strong, and women have always figured it out.
I want to be in charge of the social calendar and not attend any of the social.
Sounds good. So let's talk the opposite side of this, since we're on this topic. The three of you write about a woman's obligation as well. It's a strong part of your stories. How do we balance this when we're talking about historical fiction? How do we balance an independent character with a family obligation, a moral obligation, an obligation to the times? How do you do that?
I look at it as family back then is like a family business would be now, because family was the business. And as we've all indicated, every member had to do their part for that family to survive.
Mm-hmm.
In where I write, in England, around that the turn of the century, the eldest son would inherit the title along with everything else, everything. But he also inherited a ton of responsibility because the whole family now turned to him for their livelihood. And it could be something as simple as doling out allowances if they had the money, or seeing to it that the younger sons got appropriate commissions in the military or an appropriate job, like maybe they could study the law or something along those lines. As far as the women go, it was pretty much their job to marry well, and that would vary from family to family. What does the family need? Do they need influence? Do they need political influence? Do they need money? And they would seek out what they needed and go get him, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's like running a business.
Well, my characters always sort of wanted to fall in love, you know, the most. But in this book, she does have that obligation to try to save her family because they're going to lose their home, lose their social standing, which they weren't the real rich. In fact, I was, most of my characters are actually small town characters in my books, or they're not rich. They're just country people in the mountains. They're mountaineers, so... this book was a little bit of a departure by writing by a more wealthy family, and I told a couple of my girlfriends when I went out to lunch with them, it says, I can't write about rich people because I don't know anything about them. I've never been there.
Same booth, same.
Somehow it came through, and Elena is an artist, wants to draw, so she does in some ways think about things that she might be able to do besides marrying well, but nothing she thinks of is going to help her family. She would never be able to support her twin brothers that are 14 or her sister who is 16 and keep them from having to go out and join the labor market. So the rich husband was the answer. It didn't turn out to be the answer, but that was the answer.
Well, it's really interesting, especially when you're talking about love. And, of course, the notion of love and why do we get married so frequently gets used as a stick to beat women.
Right.
Because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You can never get married or not get married for the right reason. And this has been going on since the institution started. There's a great book out there called The History of Marriage. Fun fact, marrying for romantic love has only actually really been possible since the 1970s because two things happened. Women got, it was illegal to pay women less, you know, that much less than men. Women got financial independence and the birth control pill happened. Before then, you could not have a relationship purely for romantic love, especially not a sexual relationship.
You couldn't get a credit card without your father back then.
Or your husband.
Until like 83.
Credit cards, apartments. Like I lived in Lake City for a while, and I was talking to one of our neighbors, and she was independent from the age like of 20 to 35, and that was like the 80s. Her dad had to fly down to Houston from Massachusetts to sign a lease for her. Because they wouldn't let her get enough. She was hired on and recruited by NASA, and nobody would give her an apartment.
In the 1820s, it was illegal for a woman who had male relatives to sign a contract. It was illegal for a married woman to sign a contract. She could not hire her own servants. She could not hire a lawyer to start divorce proceedings. She was femme covert, which literally means hidden. As soon as if she was single, she was femme sole, woman alone. It was a legal designation. And she could make contracts, and because she didn't have anybody to do it for her. As soon as she married, they became, you know, flesh of my flesh. Flesh was his. She was hidden from the law. She was no longer a legal entity. But, again, if we look at it's what Diane said. It was a business arrangement for women of the upper classes, especially, but of all classes. What you were looking for in a husband was someone who was going to treat you decently. You know, there were standards of decency. Is he going to treat me decently? Is he a hard worker? Is he a sober man?
Yes.
Very important.
They were able to hide that a lot easier back then.
Yeah. Is he a sober man? And is he going to put his shoulder to the wheel so that we as a collective family prosper?
Yes.
So it was, while romance was nice for most women, most of the time, romance was a luxury. We were looking for a business arrangement.
And I have one thing to that, too, with regards to the laws. The laws generally did not favor women because men wrote the laws, so they wrote them to favor themselves. But there was also, in practice, things tended to happen differently. And only when there was contention did they bring the law in. Custody. A lot of times, in France anyway, women were awarded custody of the children at least half the time. But the men still had, and I can't remember what it's called, but a legal term that meant they still had a say. So in other words, they could say, you know, you're going to go to this school, that type of a thing. But we just found ways around this stuff. So the practice wasn't always as strict as the law would have you believe.
Yeah, it was entirely different in England. Women had not only no assumption of custody, but absolutely no legal right. The children were his. If you want to read about this and what could happen with it, I recommend the lesser-known Bronte sister. Anne Bronte wrote The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, which is one of my favorite of the Bronte books, and she addresses this issue head-on.
I love this, actually. Since we're talking about all this research, one of my favorite parts of historical fiction is the fact that we do get to learn about the past, right? We study, we dive deep, we dig into the past to make these books come to life, right? So tell me, what's your favorite part of the research process? And anything fun you think you've learned or surprising along the way?
I love research. I live for this research. Some people don't like it. I adore it. Fun fact, sons of, actually the children of George III, between them, produced, wait for it, 52 children. Three of them were legitimate.
Jesus.
Research is always fun. That's how you find your new ideas. I set most of my, all of my books are set in Kentucky because I am a Kentuckian. I've grew up in Kentucky, have always lived there, so I know the people there and the history. So I've enjoyed delving into the Kentucky history and finding unusual things that maybe I didn't know until I found out. I wrote a book set on a showboat back in the late 1800s.
I love this.
I didn't write it like back in the late 1800s, but it was set back in the late 1800s.
We're not judging.
But it was very compelling history when I came across a autobiography or a memoir of a family that actually lived on a showboat and went down the Ohio River, and every night they stopped at a different place and put on their show, and sometimes they got rotten tomatoes thrown at them, and sometimes they made money, but they lived for that life, and I my characters then are on a showboat. And
I love this.
They always land on the Kentucky side, however. They never go to the Ohio. I'm sorry. They never go to the Ohio side.
No. It's literally the Ohio River.
I know it's the Ohio River.
You know what?
But they
I'm not
the
from
Kentucky,
but Team Kentucky.
Forget you, Ohio.
So I like finding those nuggets of history. And one of the nuggets that I used in this one was that Christopher Columbus Graham, who owned the hotel, he was an amazing man. He lived to be, I think, over 100 years old. And they said at one time he knew every man in America that was an important person in history. He knew them already. And he believed in exercise. He was a soldier. He went to school and became a doctor. He liked his spring water that he drank for his health. And I really enjoyed putting his history in my
wonderful.
Book a little bit too.
I love that
as well.
Though. Like, but we do that, right? As I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt again. We do that as writers, right? We attach ourselves to someone historically, and we dive into it. I don't know if any of you know who Deborah Harkness is, but during her research process every time. The whole reason we have Discovery of Witches is Matthew Boyden was a mystery to her. She didn't like, she couldn't figure out who this guy was. And her job, her degree is literally, she has a doctorate in research. Yeah, and she's like, who the F is this guy? And she's like, you know what? He's a vampire. I figured it out. And that's how she, and she just took off.
It makes sense.
So, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but no. But like, that's why we do this, right? Because somebody's bothering us.
I don't use real people in my fiction very often, but I did in this book. Mm-hmm. I've done it a couple of times. And Sarah Bernhardt. So it's set in Paris, yes. And I'm using Sarah Bernhardt, and I better get this right. So there's many biographies by her. I read about three different biographies. Then I wrote her autobiography, or her memoir. And I would read a section of one and go, wait a minute, this is kind of like the story I read over there, but it's different. And then once, as I'm looking through this, she never told the same story twice. She just embellished depending on who she was talking to, and her memoir is way off. She has in there three different birth dates and birthplaces. And because the Hotel de Ville burned down at one time, her records are lost, so we'll never know when and where she was born.
She didn't want you to know how old she was.
She didn't want you to know anything. It was really, and not that she was secretive, but that she was recreating herself all the time. Just, she would just make it up as she goes along. And what I kind of learned most about her was that she was whoever she needed to be at the time. And it works beautifully because I wasn't just using her as a backdrop person. She's a suspect and she's a witness, and so it was a big deal. But she was a friend of hers, Alexandre Dumas, once said about her, now Sarah Bernhardt is known for her waif-like thinness. Nobody says anything about her without talking about how thin she was. And what he said of her is, Sarah is such a liar, she might even be fat.
that's an amazing quote.
Facts. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. You three, I just got so invested. I was just,
I know,
like,
I'm like, here.
Sarah.
Mm-hmm. See, I absolutely love that because that's another thing that women have always done is they've always reinvented themselves at need. The reason the Useful Woman books exist is because I decided that if I was starting, I was writing Regency romance, and I decided if I was going to go trolling for ideas, I was going to read the books that were being written at the time. They were called the Silver Fork novels. They were romances or you know, comedies about the upper classes. By the way, don't. I've read these things, so you don't have to. But there was at the time a ballroom called Almack's that was literally the center of the Marriage Mart, and it was run by a board of women, and the women were run by Lady Jersey. Lady Jersey came from a family that was known for sleeping around. For profit.
Hey, it happens.
You know.
A girl's got to get her by somehow.
You know, and sleeping around for profit and to get her husband better positions at court. This was a thing. It happened a lot. A lot of the you know, those 53 illegitimate children? Yeah, those guys, they favored married women so they could deny paternity.
And they are all mildly related, so they all looked the same.
This was a woman who decided that she was not going to be looked down on, so she got her friends together who all had similarly checkered backgrounds and said, we are going to create the most exclusive club in London. We are going to tell everybody that there is no way to get in, sorry. Mm-hmm. And suddenly people were beating down their doors.
Everybody wants what they can't have.
And it was a really boring place.
And it was boring as...
I didn't do it.
Sorry. Somebody wrote a tell-all about them called Almack's that was an expose of how they worked. And in the middle of this, two lines, as I was reading this book, someone saying, oh, yes, she's become such a useful woman. Mm. I'm like, wait a minute, what the fuck is this? Why hasn't anybody told this story?
Yeah.
Here we are.
While you three are still in the same genre, you touch on different times and places. This, with your research, makes your books intriguing, interesting, and very complex. I'm an audiobook girl, through and through. You guys obviously saw IRL, I'm dyslexic. And you couldn't help but notice that each of you used different touches of the era in language. How did you tap into this and work this into your books? How did you seamlessly make it accessible, but also make it part of the times?
You can pick up the rhythm and speech patterns and also word usage just from reading old books, which is where I probably get most of it. And it is funny because as I'm in there writing, I hear it in my head. And a lot of times when I'm done, I'll, you know, I've got to run up to the store. And so I go to the store and I just start speaking in this high class, working. And everybody's like, what? But it works with the book. But yeah, a lot of, I don't know, I think where I'm at, a lot of the words, they translate. You know, I shall do this. I mean, people still.
What is this book 8 for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've been in that world a hot minute, friend.
Yeah. I do have that voice down, I think, yeah.
I mean, you kind of know your characters by now when you're in a series.
Yeah.
Well, my books are not series. They're all mostly standalone. I do have those cozy mysteries that were series. I have two family drama types, Rosie Corner series and the Holly Hill series that have 3 books each. But most of my books are standalone books. I wrote a lot of books about the Shakers that are still all standalone books because what ties them together is actually the setting.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I don't have a series of mysteries like these ladies do. But in my books, the character comes to life for me. And the voice comes to life when the character does. A lot of my books, or several of my books, are set in Appalachia. And so I get the Appalachian. Well, I'm a country person, and so I talk country. So
same.
The Appalachian is sort of natural for me, although I did read a book by James Steele, The Wolf Pen Notebooks, where he went to the mountains and stayed 40 years. And he just started writing down the odd things that he heard people say. He was not from the mountains. And he wrote, then somebody told him to put it in a book. And so you can get that book, and there's just all kinds of funny things that the Appalachian people say. One of them was that he's so lazy he can't fall out of a tree. And another
You've
one,
met
he's,
my
so
brother?
Mean, he's so mean that poison ivy won't break out on him. So, you know, those kind of things. Then, and I can sort of stick those into my book and make them come to life. And a lot of that comes from, as she said, research.
Mm-hmm.
When you're researching, like I was researching the Graham Springs Hotel, that those voices, you hear those voices of the characters in as they come to life in your imagination. And hopefully they come to life in your readers' imaginations.
I'm lucky. I was, you know, of course, writing in the time period of one of the greatest novelists of the English language, so I just read a lot of Jane Austen. And then this was the birth of the modern English novel, so there was a lot going around Jane Austen. So it's just, and there were endless collections of letters and diaries and memoirs. So you read enough of that, you pick up some of the slang, some of it translates, some of it doesn't. You know, you kind of have to, you sit back and you're like, no, that was the expression, but we're not doing that, no. And you know, you're aware you got a modern reader, so you learn to find that balance to put in enough that the reader's going to get the flavor. It's like salt.
Yeah.
You don't want to use too much, but you want to use just enough so that the rest of it pops.
Mm-hmm. That makes complete sense.
And if you do use a word like in the mountain, my Appalachian books, they go shankmare, and that meant they wet my foot because they didn't have a horse.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use that, you have to sort of explain what it means to the reader, because the reader hasn't ever heard that before. So you do have to sort of make sure if you use something unusual that you somehow let the reader know what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, thank you, ladies. Before
we end this, I'd love to open it up to crowd questions. So it's y'all's turn. Don't be shy.
Just raise your hand. We'll repeat the question so everyone can hear it.
So the question is, what is the most interesting thing you've had to research?
Okay, if I'm going to go first, I really think Sarah Bernhardt is probably, she's going to take it. She was amazing. She was, I can't even think of anybody today who is to us like she was to the French. And that was kind of the issue in that she looked like a suspect. And
there was not...
there was not a French policeman worthy of being called French who would be willing to arrest her.
Well, I have researched many things that were very interesting to me. The Frontier Nursing Service in Mary Breckinridge in the Appalachian Mountains during the Depression, or earlier than the Depression era, the midwifery of the area. I loved reading about that. I have really enjoyed about the book women who took those books up into the mountains. I enjoyed the people taking the waters at Graham Springs. I wrote a book once about the cholera epidemic in 1833. That one I think is here too, called River to Redemption. And my initial idea was the spark of my idea was that there was a slave that stayed in this little town of Springfield. His owner, back then they thought cholera was caused by bad air, so everybody would leave town when somebody got sick. And so his owner gave him the keys to the hotel, told him to take care of things, didn't care if Lewis lived or died. Lewis could have run away, he did not. He stayed and he took care of the people there in the town that were ill, that did not have anybody to help them. He buried all the people that died. He dug 55 graves and buried 55 people.
What a strong human.
And 12 years later, his owner died. They're going to sell him at auction because he's a slave. The town remembered what he had done, took up money, bought his freedom, and set him up in a blacksmith. Well, I wrote a fictional story about how that might have happened. So that was very interesting.
Well, yeah, as you say, what a remarkable human being. I couldn't have done that.
I'm running away. I'm scared.
Oh, I'm tossing the keys down the well and I'm out of there. I love researching Queen Victoria. I loved learning about her childhood and the nature of her rebellion against what was done to her. I also loved researching the utterly bonkers situation around George IV and his two, yes, count them, two wives. His wife, Mrs. Fitzherbert, and his legal wife, Queen Caroline. Bananas.
Anyone else?
First, and then we'll go.
Instantly forgot it. Is there any, like, location or other time period? Because it sounds like you often write similar time periods or locations. Is there any other ones that you're like casually interested in that you can't get out of your head and might write a book about?
The question is are they going to write about any other time/location?
I don't know if I'll write this, but I'm really, really fascinated. This would have been, I'm going to say, 15th century Paris. There was a very famous poisoner, Madame de Brinvilliers. I can't believe I remembered that. She poisoned her husband, her father, and her brother, and was caught at the time she was about to poison her husband. And the reason she was caught is because the man she was involved with, and why she did all this, was released from prison, and he found out that that's what she was doing. So he's like, wow, this chick is kind of out there. Maybe I don't want anything to do. So he turned her in. But in the meanwhile, this went on for a couple of years while she was perfecting her poisons and using them on people who used to be out. The poor people used to just kind of congregate in front of Notre Dame. And, you know, they're cold here, drink this chocolate laced with my newest concoction. You know,
God forbid, a woman liked to do her research.
Yeah, she did. I think she may have enjoyed it a little too much. But that's a story I would really love to write.
Well, I've written in a lot of different time periods. I think I've been in 1812. I've gone all the way up to the 1960s. Then I had some contemporaries. So the history is what draws me in. And whatever time period it is, I'm for it. Now, I haven't gone, don't aim to go back to the 15th century. So I like to think that I might know more about the 1800s and forward.
I'm fascinated by the Impressionists and by the Paris art world and how much it was like rock and roll at the time. So I would love to write something in Impressionist era Paris.
We had one more question in the audience.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question for Anne Gephardt, if that's okay.
Yes.
I was wondering if in your books, do you judge history through the lens of modern ideals or the context and ideals of the era in which you're writing? Or a combination of both, and what value that perspective has.
I think that's too hard a question for me.
That's too bad it was for you directly.
Well, I think that I drop my characters down into a historical situation, and I sort of look at the lens through them, and I don't really, I think of everything through my characters. More. And sometimes, like I said, I have the real character that I research, and that certainly helps place what I'm doing too, because Mary Breckinridge was in the nursing stories and she was real, and I had her history, and Christopher Columbus Graham was in this one, but usually it's just the character that I drop down and we see what happens next.
Isn't that a lot of writing? Just throw that character in there and we'll figure out what happens next.
Sorry, did I interrupt someone? Okay. We do have some time still. Are there any other questions?
Okay. I'm going to steal this from somebody else at a different panel. But they asked, are you a plotter or a pantser?
Yeah,
that's our favorite question.
That's our favorite question. So the question is, are you a plotter or a pantser? And for those that don't know, in the writing world, you either are one of two things. You plan everything out, or you just throw it on the page and hope for the best.
Or you reject the false dichotomy.
That's
being enforced upon us by our internet overlords.
So you're a plot pantser too.
I'm a hot mess. Ditto.
I don't like outlines. Actually, I took a writing course way back when I started, and the last assignment was to write an outline of a novel. I wrote the novel instead, and then I found out that's what I really wanted to do forever in writing, was to write a novel. So I'm all pantser. I put my fingers on the keys and hope my characters tell me what next.
The invisible friends are talking to you.
I do the history research, and I do think about my characters before I start, but I don't always know what's going to happen. Things happen and change. I do have to write a proposal for my editor to see if they'll buy my book, but things always change in the writing.
Yeah, things always change. I am a plotter. Mm-hmm. I plot the crime, you know, who, what, where, when, why, how, before I even start plotting the story.
You have to. I've read your first in that book. You have to. You are so detailed. You are so detailed.
Well, thank you. I try. I like the details. However, having done that, because I plot and then I plot the book and then I usually do it a second time, and that's the one that goes to my editor. And even with all that planning, things change, because a new character that you brought in just totally refuses to do what you want them to do. And you're like, okay, this is not working. And when I have problems, it's usually because I am struggling with a character who doesn't want to do what I want them to do. So I have to rethink this, and the plot changes, and then the editor gets a new outline. And so, yeah, things will always change, but I got a plot.
So the author, Emma Barry, is a really good friend of mine. She writes romance, and she lives in Virginia, very close to where I live, so we've become good friends. And the amount of times that she's told me, I submitted the book like this, and they were like, we won't buy it unless you do this. So she rewrites the entire book. shops it again. Okay, but we want this in there. And then she has to rewrite the entire book. And this has happened to her several times. She just sold another book that I can't give too many details on, but mm-hmm. I know because, again, she's my friend. And this one is like, it was sold as the concept. And it's the first one that she didn't have to like redo. Matt Denneman told us yesterday that he is a complete pantser. He is writing book 8 of a series that has to be collectively read together, like in order. And I was like, so you don't know what happens to your main character and you are 8 books in? He's like, I have no idea. Writing by the vibes. And I'm like, how?
He doesn't know if Carl's going to live or die.
It stressed me out for him.
Yeah, that makes me so nervous.
Yes.
See, I mean, I joke about it. But I really do actually have a problem with how that the plotter versus pantsers thing has become such a dichotomy, because pretty much everybody I know, it's a combination. It can be different at different times. It can be different for different books. The best thing I ever heard about it is you do not learn how to write novels. You learn how to write this novel.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because for me, it's been different every single time.
Every time.
When I was coming up, I got so concerned that I wasn't a real writer because I wasn't doing what all the writers told me I should be doing. And it took me 40 years now to stop shooting all over myself.
Yeah. we had this conversation at our panel yesterday. How to save the cat, write the novel. I hate that book. I hate that book as a writer because it puts a lot of pressure on young, new writers who are interested and excited about being in this industry, and thank you, and they get really discouraged with that book.
Mm-hmm. I think all writers have their own way to write, and you know, I could not plot a book and write it because I would feel like I had already written the book. Yeah. I cannot tell anybody about a book I'm writing. Yeah. I cannot even tell my family.
Oh, I'm terrible.
I might
at the
tell
elevator
about
pitch.
The idea, the history, but then I have to be the person that is reading the book, writing the book.
I want to thank you all for coming today, Darcy Wilde, Anne Gayhart, and Dan Freeman, for sharing your time with us and your stories today. Their books are going to be upstairs, and you guys are signing next. So we're going to let them sneak out first, guys.
And so you know, if you haven't already been to a signing, it's all the way back on the second floor. That's where you can also pick up their books and find them for their signing. So we're going to let them go first. But thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
This was incredible.
Thank you for your time.